It's pretty good exercise. Did you learn anything along the way? Did you see pieces come together and how to go about the process and think about it? Fantastic. For those of you who stayed yesterday afternoon, you might remember that we went through and created a little bit of a script, right? Well, Andy said to me as we were leaving yesterday, he said, hey, we should try to run that script against the first scenario and see what happens. So let me just make this a little smaller so we can kind of see it here. So I've got the whole script here. This is the entire thing. Now, I've actually I tried to push it out into my GitHub repository just a second ago, and I don't have the key on this laptop to do that. So I'll have to push it in when I get back home. I will stick the URL for the GitHub repository up on the screen, though, so you can grab this, and I've got some other bro scripts and some scapy scripts and stuff out there. Can you remind me, can anybody walk me through, or can you help me walk through, what does this logic do? Because there are a few people who weren't here. And I'm not asking you, you know, line by line, but remember our threat analysis? What were we looking for first?
Links in an email.
Links in an email. And when we found a link in an email, what did we do? We then watched for DNS resolution involving that name. And if we saw that, what did we do?
Generate an alert.
Well, we didn't generate. We then watched for any outbound connections to those addresses, whatever addresses came up, right? And we would remember that over time. So this would become a way to find outbound connections to things that people click links on. I have made only one little change to it. I just made it a little bit smarter at the bottom here. So I'll explain what I've done at the bottom. And I know that's a little tough to read if you're in the back row there. It's simply checking to see which port it's going to. If it's going to port 80, it's going to let you know, hey, that was a web request. If it's going to 443, hey, that was SSL or TLS. And if it's going to something else, it's going to get a little more excited because you're now connecting to that machine on some other port. That's all I've changed. With no other change, I'm just going to run the capture file you were just dealing with through that script. Is that anything close to what you were finding? That's pretty cool, right? So we could see that there's, and remember we said yesterday there can absolutely be false positives on this one. So you might look at the web request stuff and say, maybe they're clicking on an FTD link, or maybe it's a Facebook link or a LinkedIn link. But then when you see, there's connections to some other port going on, whoa, that should definitely get our attention. Yesterday I asked you a question. I said, so seeing how powerful something like that is it something that you'd look at and say, that is worth either me or someone on my team spending a day or two figuring out how to do that stuff? Yeah. And I hope more so now, if you look at the time you spent and then see that and say, wow, you know what? That would have been minutes. I would have had my answer. And if I'm talking about the approach between alert-driven and data-driven, what we did yesterday is we did a data-driven analysis that is now producing new alerts that we never had before. We can go and react to those. I will put the link to where you can't get the script today, right? You understand that because I can't push into GitHub right now. I don't have my key here. But I will give you the URL to where my repository is so you can grab that script later. Excellent. Let's talk about something else then. I also, before we kind of jumped into that, we were talking just a little bit about SSL. So I thought we'd take a few minutes and just talk about different strategies, different approaches to dealing with encrypted data, TLS and SSL particularly. Obviously the problem is that if Alice and Bob are using SSL or TLS or any other encrypted channel, then our analysis tools are simply not going to be able to read the data. So there are a couple of approaches to this problem. They all have pros and cons. One of the approaches is we use a perimeter device that is going to break open every connection. Effectively, what it's doing is terminating the connection. So with this kind of device, when Bob tries to go out and talk to Alice, his packet is not being passed through for proxies using SSL, you can actually have an end-to-end connection even through proxies using what's called the connect method, which is sort of a tunnel through the proxy. This is not that. He is becoming a proxy. He's making himself a proxy. Even if you haven't reconfigured your browser, you are now connecting to this machine. So you are encrypted here. You are connected to him. He will then connect to Alice, and this will have an entirely different key. So key one and key two, these are two different connections. Does that mean that our friend here can suck packets out of there where they're decrypted? Yes. So I can now do my analysis. What will Bob see when he tries to connect to Alice's website? You're going to get a certificate error. You're going to get a certificate error, usually, because you're trying to connect to Alice.com and you're getting a certificate, but it's not for Alice. You're getting him. So it's going to complain. That means, though, that Bob is now being trained that anytime he goes anywhere on the internet, he is going to get a bad certificate. What if this isn't Alice? What if through some means, DNS spoofing, whatever, through some means, this isn't Alice, this is Eddie? Does Bob ever have an opportunity to realize that? No. Because he always sees a broken certificate. Okay, so we can make that a little bit better, at least from a user experience point of view. Let's enter this guy over here. This guy is Bill. Bill is our Windows administrator. Bill has deployed PKI using a certificate server, and he's done auto-enrollment for all of the machines within the domain. Bob is using one of those machines. And what he has also done is he has pushed out certificates. Well, a trusted certificate root for everybody who's in the domain. And what we can now do is dynamically generate a certificate here that is trusted by this root. It's generated from this root. So while he's trying to go to Alice, he's really connecting here, but the key he's getting was signed by Bill. Does he trust Bill? He trusts Bill. So he will not get a certificate warning. He will have a nice green bar. He's still intercepting the connection. We still have an SSL connection over here. So for user experience, this is wonderful because Bob will never get a certificate warning. We can still sniff the traffic. What's the downside of this? We're still not validating who we're actually talking to. Now, if I want to make that better, I would have to, in this device, have it only accept valid certificates, things where the IP address matches the thing and the signature's valid and all that. That's more processing on this box. Many times they're not configured to do that. Sometimes you'll find this happening at a much higher level. There have been a number of cases where certificate authorities have been convinced to issue certificates for other organizations, like Google. Why would someone like, let's say, the government of Iran or the government of China, why would they be interested in getting a certificate for Google? People will trust it because it came out of a CA. So your browser is going to trust it just because it trusts the CA. So it's going to say, oh, okay, that's a valid certificate for Google. But why would they want that certificate? What? Because now that's effectively the same thing as what we're doing here with Bill. Because now we can be a man in the middle for anyone in the country who's going to Google for web searches or Gmail or anything else. One of Google's strategies toward this is that their certificates are only valid for a couple of months at a time. The problem is, if I get a certificate authority to issue me a certificate that's good for 10 years, as long as I trust that certificate authority, I have no idea that Google's changing their certificates. It doesn't matter for me. This is a big deal. You might also find that rather than breaking this open. There's devices specifically for this, for breaking these open. And you can also whitelist stuff. You can say, you know what, if they're going to Google, I don't care. If they're going to Facebook, I don't care. If they're going other places, I want to know what they're doing. Or vice versa. If they're going to Facebook, I want to know what they're doing. You can control what happens. So there could be a device specifically for that. You'll also find that your UTM devices, so these are the unified threat management devices. This would be things like Palo Alto firewalls. One of the things that these include within them is the ability to terminate SSL connections and interfere. And you can subscribe to services so that it will then do cloud-based analysis, and you can do packet capture on the device and all that kind of cool stuff. So there are technologies to deal with that. There are risks associated with it. The biggest risk being our users can potentially identify if they're being misdirected to the wrong site. These devices are going to be much worse at that. And part of why they're worse at that, do you run into bad certificates on real legitimate sites? Yeah, so that's a problem. So it creates issues, but it is possible to do. Good? All right. If you're trying to inspect the data going to your own website, that is a different problem. What you there use is an SSL accelerator. So that's a product that sits in front of your web server itself. That could also be in your WAF, your web application firewall. So user inbound connections are not actually to your server, they're to that device. That device is then relaying the connection over HTTP, and your inspection happens after that. I don't care that I'm breaking the connection open because I still have the end-to-end connection out to the customer, and I'm just doing the inspection. The only real issue, the dangerous issues, come into play when I'm trying to be the man in the middle between my users and other people on the internet. Okay. Well then, let's add in another tool. We've got another scenario we'd like to go through here to introduce the scenario. Hang on. Let me get my slides up here. Okay. To introduce the scenario, we also want to start dealing with how do I handle large packet captures. So far in the class, we've been very, very fortunate. What's happened is other people along the way have somehow managed to extract exactly the packets we need to be able to analyze a particular event. Hasn't that been great? But that is not always going to be the case. Sometimes we need to go chase that stuff down. We need to find the bigger packet the big packet capture and extract out the data. NetFlow data is a phenomenal way to do that. Silk, as I said earlier this morning, is a free implementation of NetFlow. That's what it is. One of the beautiful things about it is that I can use Silk as a NetFlow processor, and it is pretty much NetFlow agnostic. What I mean is that NetFlow itself is proprietary, and there are a variety of versions. Silk actually supports all versions of NetFlow. Now, if we're using the newest versions of NetFlow, you do have to recompile Silk with specific options to enable that, but you can support every version of NetFlow there is. That's convenient. That means that I can aggregate all of my existing NetFlow data that's coming out of existing sensors, routers, switches, things like that. But I can also turn other devices into NetFlow sensors. For instance, that could be hosts that are running collectors. It could be intrusion detection systems running collectors. Things that are not routers and switches. That's really good for us because it increases the number of sensors we can create. Silk also includes a variety of command line tools for interacting with the data, and that's actually the number one complaint that people have. While I can certainly use Silk to do all of the things that are listed here on the slide, finding things like who are the biggest talkers or most common talkers, finding the biggest flows of data that are running by or long connections or protocols in use that are unusual, I can find all those things. And there was a graphical interface that was available. It was called iSilk. iSilk has not been updated in years. It's not great to use. It's difficult to get it to compile. More commonly, you're going to interact with this on the command line. That's the complaint people have. There's no real GUI interface. But that's okay. We've spent a lot of time on the command line this week. We can handle it. For NetFlow, a flow is going to be a combination of a five-tuple or five-tuple. Does anyone know the actual right way to say that? Because I'll tell you what, in Python land, my goodness, people get really upset about how you say that word, depending where you are. So whatever you want to say it is, it's a group of five terms taken together to create the identity of what that thing is. With bro, it creates that unique ID. Not so here, it's just the five-tuple or the five-tuple. It's these things. The source IP, destination IP, source port, destination port, and the protocol. Those things taken together. ICMP is an interesting special case. I'm going to come back to that in a minute. I'm going to see if I can get you to figure out how ICMP types and codes were worked out. Yeah?
So why can't you just use bro for NetFlow?
It's not that I can't use bro for NetFlow, but NetFlow data, bro is not trying to create NetFlow records. It's an entirely different thing. And bro can't read NetFlow data. Bro is wonderful for processing data and creating logs. What this allows me to do is put the data into a repository, into some database, that I can now query at any time in the future very quickly. And that's really where the strength is. With Bro, it's going to have all those logs in there, but those logs from last week are all compressed off in another directory. I have to go find those logs and uncompress them. But if I'm using Silk, so I've got, I logged into one of our sensors so I could show you this. Here I've got a view that might look familiar. It's not the same view. Yesterday I was showing you a Bro window. This is a Silk window. This is all NetFlow data. And this is showing me things about what's going on with... these are just recent connections. This next one is the longest connections in the last hour. So I've got connections that were up to 1,800 seconds that were going on. Some of them are quite interesting. That one's quite interesting. Come back to that in a second. Top talkers, so who sent the most data. And down here, there's other stuff that's going on that's interesting. Like, this one's quite interesting. There's some machine that has self-assigned an address. Why do I have something that is self-assigning an address on my network? That should not be. So someone will have to go chase that down later. It's not me. I'm out of the office. Let's come back to this one for a second. ICMP. ICMP does not have connections. Does not have connections. What is a NetFlow record? Now, actually, if you've got your slides there, if you're looking at that, it says it's going to be the five-tuple, the flags. Somewhere in here, I don't remember where it is. It might be down in the notes. It talks about how it knows when a connection ends. The way it knows a connection ends is when it sees a fin, it sees a reset, or the connection is quiet for more than 63 seconds. 63 seconds. What's it?
Configurable.
Yes, you can configure that. 63 seconds. Why 63 seconds? It's because of TCP keep-alives. I have a session I set up, an SSH session. I log in, I type some commands, and then I leave it idle. Let's say I'm going across a firewall. This should sound like a familiar conversation. I'm going across a firewall. What might happen if I leave that idle for an hour? Firewall kills it. Why? Does it actively kill it?
No.
It just forgets about it. And now it'll get reset. So we have that idea of a keep alive. TCP keep alives are typically sent one every 60 seconds. So the default on this is 63 seconds because if it's still a live connection, there's probably going to be a keep alive coming by. It will also choose to terminate a flow once it gets over a certain time. And you know what? I was going to quote a time and I don't want to. Do you remember what the time is?
Active flow timer is typically 60 seconds and it doesn't terminate it. It just issues a flow record and then keeps it.
A new record, but what's the time? Is it once an hour? Is it 30 minutes? I can't remember. Right. But then, okay, I'm saying something different. There's another time. It's not going to log the flow until the flow ends. In order to make sure that we've got records happening, it's going to log a flow after a certain amount of time elapses, even if the session hasn't closed. It will say that's closed and we'll just start a new flow. That's what's going to happen inside of that. I just don't remember what the number is.
Yeah, sometimes the defaults are an hour, but I work with a lot of big ISPs, and we set the active timeouts at 60 seconds. So you
always have a flow, yeah.
You write a flow record, really.
Yeah, that could be. I feel like it's an hour. I just can't remember. Yeah.
Can you specify size as well? I mean,
I'm sure there's systems where you can, but not in Silk. You can't have a Silk flow and say, if more than this amount of data, now log it. No, it doesn't work that way. Coming back to this data, I've got my echo request and reply, and right now I'm printing out some data. We'll look at how to print data in a second. I can see when this flow started up. It's coming from 192.168.2.5. It's going to 2.1. It is an ICMP echo. It's been up for 1,800 seconds. Okay. ICMP is not connection-oriented. Why is it saying that, do you think? Well, it has. It's seen requests and replies. What? It sees requests and replies. Think about what that five tuple is. Who's the source? Who's the destination? What's the port? What's the protocol? And as long as it keeps seeing a packet every 60 seconds, what will it assume? That connection is still up. This is not a connection-oriented protocol. Does NetFlow care? Doesn't care. It still sees packets. So what's it assuming? Connection is up. And then at 1,800 seconds, which I think is an hour, so that's why I'm terminating there, it's saying, okay, close a flow, give you a new flow. That means that 2.5 is constantly pinging 2.1. Why? Well, I don't know. I'd like to know. I'll send an email to somebody. I will find out why that's happening. .1 is a gateway, yes. .1 is a gateway. So it's checking if the gateway is up. But why? Stop hammering my gateway. I'm interested in this field here. And you might be able to, you know, look at some of these and figure out what these are. So that's a source. Here's a source port. There's a destination host. There's a destination port. This is the number of bytes that went by. This is the amount of time it was up. Here's the protocol. So this year, it's showing zero for the source port. Okay, I can live with that, right? It's ICMP. And 2048. For the what? 2048. Hmm. 2048. I want to show you an output here. At least I thought, well, apparently I don't just have it sitting here. All right, so I'm going to quickly write an example of how you write a Silk thing, how you interact with it. Don't get freaked out by it. We got it in the slides here. You got a lab for it. RW filter. And I'm going to tell it, actually, you know what? Okay, look in your book here. Turn the page. Look, RW filter. Okay, turn there it is. RW filter. This is the command for dealing with this thing. It's slide 19. RW filter allows us to get data. As you work with it in the lab, you're going to use it in a way that you can certainly use it for forensic analysis, but it's a little bit unnatural in terms of how I use it when I've got a NetFlow repository, when I have NetFlow sensors up that are feeding data into repositories and I can just query data. I do not ever have to specify a file name, because using RW filter, I can specify how I want to get data out of my repository. I could say, I want to find all data, so all kinds of packets, look at everything. If I wanted to, I could specify a starting time with a timestamp and an ending time, and I can specify huge or small blocks of time, whatever I'd like, and it will take care of aggregating that data across all of the flow records that I have going back to the dawn of time. I want to, let's see what I want to do here. I want to look at protocol 1. That would be ICMP. Protocol 1. And that's called a partitioning criteria, the way I'm selecting data. Now that I've selected data, I'm going to say that for all of the data that passes that filter, that matches that, I want to send that to standard output. I want to pass it along to another command. Now, I'll tell you, let's just try it. If I just run that as is, it's going to say, you didn't tell me where to put that. Okay, I'll tell you where to put that. Pass equals standard out. It'll say, no. I'm not doing that because you're going to be upset with what I show you because that is just binary data. You don't just look at this data. The reason it does this is because the data is in this binary optimized searchable hashable data format, and it keeps it that way as long as it can until you actually look at output, because you can repartition the data based on what you did in your last command. We'll make this one simple, though. I'm going to send it through a command called rwcut. That sounds kind of familiar. That's like brocut, right? It's the same kind of idea. With no options, it shows me all of the fields. And wow, there are a lot of fields there. Actually, it doesn't show me all of them. It shows me a default set of fields. I'm going to reduce that. Yes, and it converts it. I'm going to reduce that. I'm going to tell it, here are the fields I want. Sorry, my terminal's a little slow here. I want fields, I want the source IP, the destination IP, the source port, the destination port. Wow, VPN has gotten slow here. And I'm also going to print out the I type and the I code. What do you suspect those are? Protocol type, ICMP types and codes. ICMP types and codes. Let's print that out. Oh, that's interesting. Okay, we get some data back. Now look at this. Type 11 code 0 has a destination port of 2816. And all of them have 2816. Type 3 code 3 has 771. Type 8 code 0, that would be an echo request, or 2048s. And they're all 2048s. Let's take the base 16 value, 0x0800, which would be the type and code field out of ICMP, and let's convert that to base 10. Oh, that's convenient. Let's clear that. Let's try another one. Let's try 0x0303, so the type 3, code 3. Base 10, 771. So what's in the destination port field? The type and the code. In fact, this isn't super important, but in fact, it does not store an I type and an I code field. It does not store that field. It stores the type and the code in the destination port to optimize storage space. And when you ask for the I type and the I code, it decodes that and shows you what those values are. And that matters because 2048 doesn't look anything like an echo request, right? Because it's in decimal. Let me back away because I am already doing things we have not covered in the class here. Let's come back. We're talking about that RW filter command. I can use that to look at my repository and select data out of it. And then RW cuts for displaying my data. Why would I use this instead of bro? I can't remember who asked me. It might have been Greg who left. He got tired of waiting for his answer. I think that's what happened there. The answer is because for me to find that same data in bro over, let's say, 5 weeks worth of data is going to be really slow. But for me to search for that inside of this repository is going to be blazing fast. So that's why we would use NetFlow. Not really, but lots of people have put together little scripts to pull them out. But there's no canned reports that come with it, no. There are some tools to create some good reports, though. We'll show you some of those. Dealing with Silk is very, very different than the other tools we've worked with because it's not about the packets. You do not have the packets. You're not looking at the packets. You're only looking at the packet metadata. Or I should say that differently, the flow metadata. Another important thing to have in your head when you try to correlate information between these different tools, be aware that these tools all look at data differently. Specifically, if you were to take a look at how much data passed, you will find that Wireshark defines that one way, Bro defines it another way, and Silk defines it another way. So that means if you're looking for a data flow that is exactly this number of bytes in length, trying to correlate that between the three tools can be challenging. So instead, you should be looking for other keys in the communication, like IP port pairs and timestamp. Those are excellent things to use. If you have packet data, you could include things like sequence numbers. Those are phenomenal to make sure you're looking at the same flow. And then in the end, when you get the data, you can compare the data. But be aware that the byte counts might vary, because one tool will count the headers as part of the count, and another tool won't. It will only count the actual payload. So you'll have a variance in numbers. Okay? All right, fantastic. RWFilter is really designed to be getting the data out of the repository, which I did a little bit of. I did not have to say where the data is coming from. It just knows. In my configuration, I can also narrow that down. I can say, I only am interested in data that came out of this sensor or out of this set of sensors. So you can narrow or widen that view however you like. You also have, I had type all. You can change that. I want to see inbound. I want to see outbound. I want to see outbound web. I want to, so there's a whole bunch of predefined kinds of traffic that you'll likely want to look at too. It's based on configuration. So inbound and outbound is defined on configuration. Your repository for Silk is typically in the slash data directory. You can change that, but that's usually where it wants to be, which you usually mount as a separate file system. So we've got a big, you know, couple of terabytes sitting out there just for logs. And inside of that, you have a configuration file for your, I forget the two names. Yeah, there's two different configuration files, and one of them allows you to define your sensors and where your networks are. So it knows what's inside and what's outside. You can use the repository, that's great, but I can also use this in investigations. If I have a PCAP file, I can convert that PCAP file into a Silk data output that I can then process directly. So as an example of that, here we've got RWP to YAF to Silk, because there's so many different formats for things. So this is going to convert it from a PCAP file into a set of NetFlow records. Once that's done, I can now access that file directly. So you notice here that the difference is that when I did mine, I did not have to specify a file because it just went out of the repository. Here I have to tell it where the file is. We don't have a repository. In looking at the flows of the data, you also should bear in mind that flows are unidirectional. So in looking at this data here, we've got a flow that goes from 195, 131, 158 to 158 to 192, 168, 1.3. From 3773 to 80, there are five packets that go in that direction. Here is what's going on with the flags. We saw a packet that had a SYN, a reset, a push, and an ACK. Am I saying that all of those bits were on in one of the packets? No. In aggregate, in that connection, we saw all of those bits within those packets. There is actually another field here that's not visible, and it's not in the default output, but you can ask for it. It's flags-initial, which is quite useful. Flags-initial. So the flags column, this column, is going to be aggregate across the whole connection. Flags initial will be flags in the first packet that was observed. Flags in the first packet observed. So if I have a connection that goes or spans across the boundary of when the flow gets written, the first packet that's seen is not going to have a SYN in it. But I can use that too, because if I'm looking at data and I see that I have a connection with data passing in it, and I don't have an initial, or in my initial flags, I don't have a SYN. That tells me that connection has been up for some period of time. I need to go back in time to figure out where that started. That could be an interesting report to run at the end of an hour and say, okay, I want to see all of the packets where there's no SYN in the flags initial. I'm interested in finding that. That would be long connections. Okay, back to this. So I've got a flow going from 195 to 192, And then on the next line, I've got a flow going from 192 to 195. Would you say that these two are related? Yeah, I think so. Can you tell me why you think they're related? Source ports and destination ports. So notice that source port here, destination port here, destination port here, source port here. These look like, and then the IPs, they look like the same connection. And could we even, if we showed flags initial, it would help even more, but could we piece together, you know what, okay, so it was probably a SYN came from this guy, and he sent back a SYN ACK, and then he sent an ACK, and then he, so I can kind of work out probably what the flow of these packets were. Those fields are here.
Yeah.
There's both a start time and an end time. It's just not being displayed on my screen right here. If I flip over here, well, let me just flip over here.
That'd be the thing you want to see, right? And
to really nail it down, yeah, I'd want to see that too. But if I flip over here and let me add in. Oops. So there's the timestamps. So it's just another field. We didn't put them in the slides because they are really wide. Yeah, so that's the only reason I don't have them there. And I can filter on those too. I can filter on anything that's in it. Okay? All right, so probably these are the same. The timestamps would really nail it down. Can we piece together? Can we... Well, this is the literal data, right? So we had 460 bytes, there were four packets, there were five packets, there were... But based on this data, with your knowledge of IP, can you probably work out most likely what this looked like, what the packets actually were? I still don't know the content, but can I work out probably SYN, SYN, ACK, ACK, and then there was maybe some data sent, and then how do we close this thing up? It looks like one end sent a FIN. What did the other end do? He reset me. And then the connection was torn down. So even without the packets, we can work out what happened in it. Make sense? Okay, cool tool. The tool to see the data is RWCut, but there are other ways of looking at the data. I might want to generate statistics on that data. So for instance, here we have RWStats. I want to see statistics based on the destination port. You can list more than one thing, more than one element you want to look at. You can look at any element you want to, the time, the size, the port, the anything you want to. And this is going to count up the top five flows that we had involving a destination port. So the most common five destination ports that appeared. Or down here, RW Unique. I want to see all of the unique protocol headers or protocol fields that showed up. How many protocols am I running? I could do that for destination ports, but ooh, I'm going to get a lot of results there because it's not just people who sent the SYN. It's going to be the SYN acts as well. So it'll be a lot of destination ports in there. But I can partition that down more. I might take something like RW filter. Let's just try it. I want to see destination ports. Let's try RW filter. And I'm going to run out of my repository, so I'll give it type equals all, so I get it out of my repository. I want to find flags initial equal to, now I always end up writing this backwards, so I feel like I always want to do that. I think that's what I always want to do. I probably have it backwards, so I might have to revise that. What I'm doing is saying I want to find SYN packets, and I want to mask so that I'm preserving SYN ACK. In other words, if you mask the bits so that only SYN ACK are preserved, is the SYN bit still turned on? So it's bit masking in another way. Now I might have my S and my SA reversed. We'll find out. So I'm looking for flags initial. I'm going to, everything that passes that filter, I'm going to send it to standard output through RW unique. So this, again, is why we keep it in that binary format. Now I can take RWUnique and do something to it. Let's look at fields equals deport. Wow. That was pretty fast, right? So now I know here are all of the destination ports that were involved. Now I might look at some of those and say, those look a little funky here. Let me add another criteria into this. Let me also say proto equals 6. It's still the same. So apparently, I'm sorry, I was looking backwards. I was looking at this, I saw the 80 and assumed that was the destination port. That was a mistake. The destination ports are over here, so there we go. So 95, 43, and 80, and 30. So now I could easily look at these and immediately say, are there any I don't recognize? Let me go chase those down. So I could start pulling out flows related to those things, see where they're going, how many there were. Good? Make sense? And while you were gone, Greg, you were asking about using this over Bro. So the reason was because since it's in this binary format, I could now specify this to say, let's start in December of 2016 to now and show me that, and it will take it like 5 seconds. But combing through the Bro con logs to do that is going to take far, far longer. So that's the answer.
Can you export this to like a text file?
Sure. Yeah, just redirect it. And I can also add in more fields, anything you want to do with it. It's a very, very powerful tool.
So using that place initially, it's scoped down to Cincinnati. Can we just use it like a three-way method, just scope it down to three-way Cincinnati?
Remember that all of the flows, so he asked, can I scope it down? I want to see three-way handshakes. Not really, because remember that all of the flows are single direction. They're one directional. So I'll have one flow that has the syn in it. I'll have a different flow that has the synac. I don't have both of those in the same flow. This is simply identifying initial syns. If I wanted to find the synacs, now that's an interesting thing to find as well. So I would look for that this way. Look for synacs when you mask off the flags and keep only the synac. That's what that says. And let me add something else to that. Dash dash source CIDR, the source address of the network, I'll make it our network, or this network. Well, 0.0/16, and I shouldn't see much, and nothing, because this is a completely private network, so nothing should be coming out. But it lets me very quickly slice and dice. I could go crazy with this, but I'm going to resist. Instead, let me finish up these slides, get you into the lab, get you to work with it a little bit, and then after that, and after lunch, then I'll come back and I'll show you some other cool things with Silk and kind of, how I can chain these together, and it's a very powerful tool. You can choose to refer to the fields by name. There's an inconsistency here that I find very irritating. If I am using RWFilter and I want to sort something or filter something based on an address, I would specify that I want to find something based on the S address or the D address or on the any address. But when I want to display that column, it is the SIP or the DIP. So just have in your mind that there are some inconsistencies between how I define my filter criteria and how I tell it what to show me. The names can change, okay? Just know that. You might also choose, if you wanted to simply use the numbers. So if you get to know the numbers well, you could say, I want to see fields 1-5, 1 through 5, comma, 10, comma, 11, and you'll just get those. But you can also use the names. Yeah, that's consistent across all of it. But if I want to use the dash, so if I want to say 1 through 5, there's no way for me to say that using the names. So that's why I would use the numbers. I would have to list each one. I'd have to say SIP, DIP, I'd have to list all of them. Yeah, that would be cool. You can also get some easy statistics out of Silk. Here we are running RWFilter against a file, looking at protocols, asking it to show me the statistics related to that. And it's telling me that it had one file. It read 12 records. 12 of those records passed my partitioning criteria, and zero failed. In other words, there were 12 packets in here, and they're all TCP. So I can even do basic statistics on this without having to display the packets. To partition the stuff, here are some, there's actually more that you can partition than this. For instance, you saw me use flags initial. I can do it by sensor. I can use it by direction. There's a lot of other things I can do. But these are the most common ones that you're going to use to partition data out. And then what you do with it, you've seen me use pass out, which sounds like a good thing to do today. Let's pass out. I'd like to do that. But I could also say things that don't match that. So the records that fail to match that, give me those. Sometimes it's easier to specify the inverse and then do something with the data that results. Print stat, we already saw. I can also see the volume of data. I can control how many records to pass as well. Very useful when you're troubleshooting, especially over a slow VPN connection on a terminal, because then if you're getting a million lines back, you can stop that. So instead, let me just see 10 for now. And once I've got it worked out, I can look at all the records. Yes. So you could just add to your pipeline. You just stick a pipe more on the end of it. Yeah, so you can do that too. Yeah.
What's the back-end database or file structure?
I'll show it to you. What's the back-end? It's not a back-end database. It is a file structure. So... So on this sensor, it is always by default going to stick it in slash data. That's where it wants to go. Let me go into in, and we've got data going back into 2016 on this one. Whoops. And let's go into May. And then there's just flat files. Well, sort of flat files. These are the binary files. So I don't want to cap these. That's going to be painful. But these are the raw stuff. And in fact, not TCP. Six. Print stat. There we go. That is just the silk file, like you're using in the lab and stuff. That's just the file. What's happening is that the tool knows where to look and how to partition that repository, but the repository is just fancy language for a directory structure that's nested that has silk files in it.
Are the silk files binary, or are they
they're not proprietary. It's an open source tool. I don't know of any other tool that will open them, though. But, you know, the format's not closed. It's all documented, yeah. Have at it. All right, fantastic. Then, wrap up. Oh, hey, that means it is back to labs. So please, if you want to work on the first one more, please go right ahead. If you're done with the first one or you're satisfied with what you've done with the first one, move to the second one, which is going to get you to work with this silk tool a little bit. And again, please feel free. Bring in all the other tools you want to, however you think about it. That's the way to approach the problem. It is currently 20 minutes to noon.
Loading with data. Is that involved in a special process?
He's going back to the repository. How does that thing get run? So I've got some processes running on the machine. One of them is a collector, and the other one is a converter. I can't remember the name of the tool that does the conversion. It's not the YAF to RWP tool. There's another tool for that. So I'm collecting the data and pushing it out as IPFIX, which is a common standard format for dealing with IP data. And then the other tool is taking the IPFIX data and shoving it into the silk log. So it's two processes that are running that are doing that.
So it monitors?
It's just scarfing up every packet that goes by and creating NetFlow data out of it. That's it. But that can also receive NetFlow data from NetFlow format or any other IPFIX sensor that you've got. It can digest all of those into one place. And that's the value of it, that I can take disparate types of data and turn it all into NetFlow. That's what's good.